delighted to be joining me. My next guest is John Velasco Mills, an entertainment virtuoso, it says here. John's done basically everything in the music business and the entertainment business that I could possibly think of. Publishing, licensing, producing, advocating, consulting. He's worked with Sammy Davis Jr., Judi Dench. He's signed ELO, ABBA, Black Sabbath, not at the same time, I hasten to add. And recently he put on a 6-hour star-studded benefit with Sir Patrick Stewart, Rick Wakeman, Julian Lennon, Sharon and Ozzy again, Jeff Goldblum, delighted to be joining me on the line from somewhere in the States, I believe, John Velasco Mills himself. John, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning. It's great to be with you.
And whereabouts are you today?
I'm in Westchester, New York right now.
Very nice part of the world indeed. If people don't know, I mean, you have a new pro. You haven't stopped since you started in the early 60s, really. And you've got this MD25. So what have you been up to recently and how did it all start?
Oh, it started many years ago. I started in the theatre in England and cutting out a lot of stuff, moved into PR and then met a guy called Jimmy Webb. Who was just starting. In our first year, we had so many hits that I became famous and I had no clue what I was doing.
Right.
So that's really the story. And I just loved the music industry and went on from there to bit by bit by bit and got very lucky on the way.
I mean, you say, you know, bit by and got very lucky, but you founded a company, Canopy Records. You'd already worked with Sammy Davis Jr. and others before then. And rather than just looking at the sort of the trendy pop music, you sort of became almost empresario, or you knew the value and you knew that there was much more than just this music. There was the entertainment, there was the songwriting, everything which went with it.
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, anyway, everything, no matter what I'm doing, comes back to music. I mean, in my mind, I'm still just a music publisher, because whether it's movies, TV, concerts, whatever it is, the music and the publishing is at the bottom of everything I do. And I love songwriters. I mean, I'm a horrible musician myself. And so basically, I live vicariously through the talent I'm lucky enough to bump into.
I mean, do you think that songwriting is a much sort of overlooked craft now? And it was perhaps in the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was a craft. And now when you go and look at the lyrics or the credits on something that's in the, and I'm showing my age, the top 40 now, it seems to have about 18,000 people writing about four words to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to me. Or the good thing is Spotify earlier this year finally put songwriter credits on, which no one bothers to do anymore, which is surprising. I mean, there are some wonderful songwriters out there still, but a lot of it nowadays is more production than songwriting, I think, on the top of the charts or whatever. And, you know, the old English saying is the hit record is the one that the milkman whistles while he's delivering your milk in the morning. And it's very tough to do that on some of these hits nowadays because you can't whistle a production.
This is very, very true indeed. One of your earliest encounters was with Ozzy was when he was in Black Sabbath. What was that like?
It was really fun. I mean, it was just really a fun time. I mean, Sabbath themselves were sort of just breaking through. And the strange thing is you'd be doing a show at like the Forum in L.A., thousands of people. And Bill, the drummer, would run off and check how the pigs were doing, which is like really back to reality after performing in front of thousands. You know, he was worried about his farm.
I mean, one of the things that I've always said about sort of looking after musicians and working in the business in the 60s, it was that there was, and the 70s, there was no real blueprint for it, if you like. And a lot of people were kind of having great fun and making it up as they went along.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was really different times. It was a very small business. I mean, if I was publishing something, the manager of that person, I mean, everyone was a team on no matter what was happening. And everyone knew everyone. I mean, people say to me, how do you know so many people? It's really easy because it was a small industry. And as it grew, you basically grew with it. And it was a, I mean, the funny thing is the money would never stop. I wish I'd known that it would eventually, but it was just money pouring in, and it's a lot of fun. No one hurt everyone. Everyone's having just a great time.
I mean, as well as sort of publishing stuff with, you know, Black Sabbath, as we said, and you signed Yes, but you were also doing theatrical shows. I mean, two of the biggest, Hello Dolly and Grease. I mean, talk about different ends of the spectrum, if you like.
Yeah, that was publishing again. I mean, the funny thing was Grease when I signed that, because when that first opened in London, it shut in about a month at the most. And, you know, and it was a very worrying time because we'd paid a lot of money for the rights. And then, of course, the movie came along and suddenly Grease was back on the stage and everything was happening. And it was another huge thing, but it just shows. I mean, when that initially came out, England didn't know what to do with it.
Well, that's an interesting one. Had it been massive in the States then, and that's why they'd made the film?
Yeah, it was really going huge in the States. And, you know, I just thought it would, you know, everyone loves that type of era music in film. And I just thought that the English public would love it on stage, which they didn't until later.
What about sort of going into the 70s? You moved to United Artists Music, so you were moving around a bit. Were you being headhunted? Were people saying he knows what he's doing and he turns up on time, sort of thing?
No, it was sort of interesting. I mean, the moves were really totally unplanned. After I was with Jimmy, basically, it was almost boring because we were having hits, but I wasn't doing anything different. It was just Jimmy. And we turned down some quite big artists. So then that's when I decided to move out and go with Hemdale and everything and do that side of it. And basically, yes, with United Artists, I'd formed my own company by then. And they basically bought me in to do it. And it gave me a lot more opportunity to do a lot more things. Things that I wouldn't have done by myself.
So, I mean, you signed some of the biggest bands of the 70s and ones whose songs are remembered fondly and have heavy rotation on all sorts of radio stations, ELO and ABBA. I mean, how did they cross your radar, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, and it was, again, I mean, ABBA is almost another total accident. I mean, I loved the song. Stig Anderson was a friend of mine, and Mike Stewart, who was head of United Artists Worldwide, and we made a deal with him, and I used to go out and listen to the songs, but the fact they were in Eurovision, really, we didn't think they stood a chance. It was really for the song and for the band, the way they looked. I mean, they didn't come in and do a big press thing like everyone else did. We just showed a video. And then on the evening, I wasn't even really looking. I was chatting to someone behind, and then someone said, "My God, you're so far ahead." And I thought he was joking, and I looked across and went, "Oh, my God, we're winning." And so, again, it was just totally being in the right place at the right time and just liking a song and liking a band.
But, I mean, the songwriting, and, you know, as you say, a lot of your career is involved with songwriters. The songwriting, you know, excellence of ABBA, I mean, these are songs that have been made into musicals, have been made into films, and the media buzz about this reforming or this hologram or whatever you want to call it coming up has been quite incredible.
It was a clever, I know people have been in touch saying, you know, are they really going to be on stage? I'm saying no, as far as I know, they've just been shot with motion capture. I mean, no, it's a very clever idea how they're just keeping it going, much like they did the Elvis show and they did a hologram of him. But this is a step further on with a live orchestra is a great idea.
It's going to be an incredible night out. You also had ELO, and again, a massive band. I mean, if you were around in the 70s, ABBA, ELO, that was pretty much your music scene covered, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's very funny as well. It's that through my whole career, I've always been in the background, and, you know, I've hated having photographs and stuff. And actually, that's the one photograph which is really fun. We launched them in a circus tent in Wimbledon, and it's one of the few photographs I've ever had with the band. But again, they were great guys. And in fact, when they broke up, I actually worked with Kelly Krukert for a while, and we did a band called Orchestra with a K. And it never really worked. They were in a Sony movie and a couple of other things, but it never really went because Jeff wasn't in it. So it, but no, it's again, it was just, again, from the publishing standpoint that we made the deal. And it just rolled on from there. I mean, I love the fact it's in so many commercials today. And the sad thing is the kids don't even know who it is. They're just hearing those songs all the time.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it, with Dreams, and suddenly Fleetwood Mac and Stevie Nicks have got a whole new audience because they hear it on an advert and they don't know those original tunes.
Right. I mean, and it's why so many of these older bands are really having a great time now, because they're performing and they actually have a sound that's very live, and that, yeah, they're all being recognized again for the first time by a new generation.
And sit back and grin, O'Reilly. You also started off with what became BMG. Were they down on the New King's Road? Was that where they were? Am I getting my geography wrong? But what was, because they
were actually in Berkeley Street. Yeah, what happened is Bertelsmann decided to, and it wasn't BMG then, to go into publishing outside of Germany. And we formed a company called Interworld. And again, that was, funnily enough, the chap Mike Stewart, who I mentioned before, who'd been world president of United Artists. And he made the original deal with Bertelsmann, and I came in to run the company. And again, that was lots of fun. But the strange thing is we bought Sunbury Dunbar, which was Hall & Oates and a lot of other artists. And then in a couple of years, Bertelsmann decided they didn't like the idea of being in publishing, which was amazing. And they sold the company and then had to buy it back, of course, later on and become BMG.
And what was your relationship like with Tina Turner? Because you were doing her music as well, weren't you? You were publishing her stuff.
Yeah, we were very close. It was basically she'd had the whole problem. Well, she had a lot of problems with Ike, etc. So we moved her to England. And again, Mike was the guy who really became her personal manager. I looked after everything in UK and set up a total touring program with Barry Marshall called Martial Arts, who now is immense and right then was very tiny, and basically made a deal with United Artists on the fact that I'd guarantee her a European tour, and make a deal with Barry that I'd guarantee her an album support if he did the European tour. In fact, he lost money on the first tour, but of course by then everyone had seen her and everyone wanted to book her from that time. But it was a great time, and she's a super person and one of the hardest workers I'd ever met.
Because people tend to, obviously, now, you know, she's a living legend, but at that time, before Private Dancer and What's Love Got to Do With It had come out, she'd gone off the scene completely, hadn't she, basically?
No, it was really hard to believe that we couldn't sell out the first tour. I mean, it's almost unimaginable today that happened. But it was exactly as I'd promised Barry, though. She's so amazing on stage that they were rebooking her before, you know, before she'd finished the show, basically. And it built from there. And then when she did the song with Heaven 17, that finally, you know, put the icing on the cake and really brought her through. But I think a lot, just people didn't know her personality either to begin with. And when they got to know her, you know, she had a personality that brought everyone in. She was just a normal person, but really bubbly. And so it was really the whole package that attracted people.
Looking through some research that I did, I'm a sort of 70s kid, and you know, I was a teen during the 80s, but certain things in your catalogue popped up, like the Cabbage Patch Kids and the Care Bear, which I remember them, and also Sesame Street. Now, I've got a huge fondness for Sesame Street because I think some of the songs in that are absolutely brilliant. So just tell me a little bit about, you know, the Sesame Street. You know, was Big Bird hard to deal with? You know, how did you handle all those egos?
Once again, it was all in music. My late partner, Joe Raposo, virtually invented Sesame Street. He wrote for 20 years all the music of Sesame Street. And he and I had the company together called Jonico. And so really it was him that brought in Jim Henson and really controlled all the music. And he used to say, you know, whenever I die, they're going to need 20 writers to fulfill the same job. And he was right. Now they have stacks of writers. But the key to it all is, he always used to say, is God forbid that the kids ever realize I'm teaching them anything. And And that was really, I think, the key to everything he wrote.
I mean, that was one of the things, wasn't it? Because Sesame Street was great fun, but, and I don't think there are really, I mean, I suppose there are shows like that, but that in that time in the 70s, the late 70s or whenever it came out, I mean, there weren't those sort of shows that had education in a fun kind of way.
Right. It was all just, it was either right between the eyes, you know, addition, subtraction and everything, or it was just a playtime. So, you know, when he comes up with songs like Being Green and even Abcadabra, I mean, no one really worked out that it was A, B, C, D, F, G. So, you know, everything he taught you something for the kids. And that's really, you know, like I say, that was the key to everything. And the other artists love it because the guests, when you think of it, some of the biggest guest stars were on that show and he'd write a particular song for that guest, no matter who they were. And, you know, it's a talent for that type of thing. I've never seen anything like it. And I think it was just a special talent he had by doing that. I mean, because he went from Frank Sinatra one day because, you know, he wrote, you know, Here's to the Winners and, you know, a lot of those big songs. So he was actually writing for big artists. And then his real job was Sesame Street.
From Sesame Street in the mid 80s, you relocated to New York. This is a fascinating one because what was it like working or helping with the acquisition of the Beatles back catalogue? Was it with Michael Jackson, for Michael Jackson? Just refresh my memory on that one.
Yeah, it was a very, it was really almost a bookkeeping job, but I'd never seen a catalogue that big, like a 1-inch catalogue thick, where you can actually go through and know every song that's in there. It was just, that was the thing that amazed me over everything else. And it took a long time and Michael Jackson actually thanked three of us at the end of it for doing it. So that was very odd, but nice.
Tell me a little bit about what you're up to at the moment then with, firstly, with MD25, what the aims of that is, because it seems like one-stop shop is the wrong word, but it seems like an all-inclusive sort of service.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I consult for several companies. I mean, for instance, there's a very wealthy gentleman that owns a lot of real estate, always does things for charity, wanted to get into the entertainment business. His attorney called me and said, please come in and help because his friends, in quotes, are coming out of the woodwork and he doesn't know what he's doing. And it was amazing some of the deals he was being ripped off for. So it's fun to sort of help people like that and then put together a business for it. I've done that for a couple of companies. My own company, I do a lot of charity production for shows, TV shows. I've got actually partnering on a funny little thing with Rick Wakeman called Rick's Place, which is on the internet now and on Glued TV, with place spelled like a fish. So it's a mixture between like Daryl's Place and Monty Python. But in everything I do, music is at the bottom. Like I say, whether it's, and this weekend I'm doing a concert tomorrow in Manhattan for 9/11 for Operation Warrior Shield, which is an incredible charity that actually they train the dogs for veterans. I mean, these dogs, they open the fridge, they get their food for them. It's amazing. So I've got a lot of artists on that, and it's a live show, which is more fun than a stream show this time, and we're doing it in Midtown Manhattan, so it's going to be a big show.
Just the thing I was going to talk about the show that you did on the 6-hour thing, but talking about tomorrow's show, I mean it's going to be a great show, but it must be a huge, well, firstly, it must be a huge honor to be involved with that, but B, it must get you a little bit nervous because of the event of what it's marking.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. The most nervous person is my wife and said, are you really going to go there? But the street is being shut or is shut already. And as well as their security, we have our own security. And, from my point of view, you know, I can't be shut down by, you know, people thinking they can shut me down. And we'll see. I mean, hopefully I'm correct. But it's going to be a fun evening, and what are you going to do? Cancel it? when there's so many people already bought tickets for it.
What was the recent situation for you like? Because obviously you've been in theatre, you've been in entertainment, you've been in music concerts all through your career. I mean, I've been speaking to a lot of musicians, many of them in the States, who are just sitting in their studios itching to get back on a stage. Has it been the same for you, itching to get something going and seeing what you could do and trying to keep, things moving along?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the greatest things, I've been working with a wonderful singer-songwriter that, for a couple of years, and called April Rose Gabrielli, and she's a tremendous artist, and that was really driving me crazy. And so, like a month and a half ago, it was great. We managed to put her on at the bitter end. We broke box office records there. Then I had her on actually a big Times Square event. So, from that point of view, getting someone that I've been working on for so long to actually get her out there and moving was one of the most frustrating things before I did it. And now she's on the Billboard Play charts. We just went up to 26. So it's thank God it's all been worthwhile. So, you're right. It was getting more and more frustrating. Like I said, streaming shows are fine. In some ways, it's a lot tougher to put together than a live show. But, again, I was sort of shocked when we got in the top 10 of shows last year because we had no idea.
But it must have been great to pull in, friends, people you've worked with, like I said before, Ozzy and Sharon, Jeff Goldblum, who is a fantastic pianist as well as being a one-off, and Sir Patrick Stewart.
Yeah, well, the nice thing is we decided to do it for three charities, a massive charity, a middle charity, and a local charity. So we did it for prostate cancer was the biggest charity. The middle charity was, which is what most of those people loved, was anti-bullying campaign. And then it was just a local Meals on Wheels for older people with COVID problems. So in that way, it covered everything. And the show itself, it went from total unknowns to big stars and people talking. And that was what we got the most reaction from, is that even if they didn't like one act, the next act was like, oh, we really like this one. So we were just lucky putting the whole show together in a way that everyone liked something. And most people stayed on. The figures were huge. Through the 6 hours, they were coming in and out, which was, that was the amazing thing. So it worked.
I mean, even after several years, I'll say, in the business, I mean, I've always described any sort of show promotion as crisis management and chaos theory at all times. Do you still get the same buzz, the same thrill for getting everything organized or signing a new, like you said, the young lady that you're promoting now, or discovering a great singer-songwriter?
Oh, absolutely. It's still, like I said, I live through the songs and the songwriters, and it's still... Even if I'm putting a show on, it's the same thing, because you still get the same rush, you still get the same panic, the same problems. And when it's over, it's hopefully feel really good when you pass the check across.
Well, we wish you all the best with tomorrow's show. It's probably going to be a very emotional occasion as well. If people want to find out more about what you've been up to, where can they find more information about you? The company itself, MD25, has a website?
Yes, we're md25.nyc. We made it very, very easy.
Well, it's been a pleasure to speak to you. So many great stories. Good luck tomorrow, as I said. John Velasco Mills, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun. Talk to you later.